Welcome to the Embodiment Conference. My name is. Oh, it's just not going to work at all. Never accept a dare from Mark Walsh. Welcome to the Embodiment Conference. My name is Leslie Kaminoff, and you may know me as the co-author of the international bestseller, Yoga Anatomy. But I'm also the co-founder of yogaanatomy.net. Now, that's a platform we built 11 years ago where we offer online courses and in-depth anatomy modules that support teachers, teacher trainings, and students all over the world. So that's why we are thrilled to be sponsoring all the incredible sessions here on the Yoga Channel, including my own. And if you feel a connection with the way I teach, I have some great news for you. We are extending scholarships to all members of the Embodiment Conference. And you can find that scholarship info and links to yogaanatomy.net in the description for this presentation and in the show notes. In the meantime, enjoy your body, enjoy your breath, and enjoy your conference. And I'll see you online.
Dr. Andrea Jain. Andrea is an associate professor of religious studies at Indiana University, the editor of the Journal of the American Academy of Religion, and author of Selling Yoga from Counterculture to Pop Culture, as well as Peace, Love, Yoga, the Politics of Global Spirituality. We're honored to have you today, Andrea, and I will hand it over to you.
Great, thanks so much. I'm going to share my screen now. Let's see here. I just want to make sure I do this right. Let's see. Okay, so can everybody see my screen? All right, so I'm going to give a sort of academic talk, but hopefully I don't slip into too much academies here, since I know we have a broad audience of people who are interested in yoga from a scholarly perspective, but also and more so even from a practitioner perspective. This is a talk that's based on a book that I just published, Peace, Love, Yoga, The Politics of Global Spirituality. It's just been published with Oxford University Press. And I just want to thank the organizers of the Embodiment Conference for hosting me and inviting me to speak on this recent work that I've been doing. So we've all heard the expression, you are what you eat. And historically, the extent of religious concern, I'm interested in religion because I'm a scholar of religious studies. The extent of religious concern about what, when, or how a person eats is met only by concerns about with whom, when, or how a person has sex. Hence, attention given in many religious systems, especially the history of yoga, to purifying the body through rigorous control over diet and fasting alongside celibacy. And today, especially in global cities around the world, religion and yoga is as much about what a person buys, another kind of consumption. Hence, my scholarship theorizes what I call neoliberal spirituality as a social, economic, political, cultural, and religious project. I locate its disciplines, discourses, and institutions of self-care, including the yoga industry, within capitalism. So drawing cases, especially from the global yoga industry, I try to tease out their relationship with the dynamics of capitalism and the tendency to wed the goal of material prosperity to the quest for liberation, rooted in some form of ancient wisdom or exotic wisdom. Personal growth, self-care, and transformation are just some of the generative tropes we often hear in spiritual settings. In its discourses, we find a narrative that frames things in terms of market value, reflects certain assumptions about human existence, value, and purpose, and works hard to regulate authority. Huge swaths of consumers in global cities all over the world spend their money on spiritual commodities, hence the emergence of large transnational corporations, indeed entire industries, producing neoliberal spirituality's products. Let's see here. There we go. So the analysis that I'll get into in a minute builds on my first book, Selling Yoga from Counterculture to Pop Culture, which pivots around the question of how the study of yoga can help us better understand religion's role in consumer culture. In Selling Yoga, I combined theoretical, historical, and cultural approaches to explore the yoga boom in contemporary culture, arguing for a double thesis. On the one hand, yoga has always taken multiple forms in the many pathways of its historical development as a part of South Asian religious history, and has continued to do so through modern yoga's evolution and popularization. On the other hand, although the yoga industry's devotion to fitness, self-care, and health mirrors consumer culture's emphasis on self-development through careful consumer choice, for many yoga practitioners, yoga's religious or spiritual qualities have not been eliminated. They've been transformed. So even though the yoga industry, in other words, was birthed by consumer culture, it remains deeply religious or spiritual, even in, and in some cases through, acts of commodification, the buying and selling of yoga. My insistence that we study commercial yoga as a body of religious practice serves as a critique of competing studies that bemoan consumer branding, commodification, and popularization of yoga and other spiritual commodities as the loss of imagined, pure, authentic religious practices. Approaches that claim, in other words, that contemporary commodified forms of yoga should be taken less seriously than the so-called authentic forms. So whereas in Selling Yoga, I asked how yoga practitioners shared many qualities with what we often imagine as traditional religions, including things like demarcating sacred spaces and time, creating communities built around shared values, posing solutions to the problems of suffering and death, and constructing and sharing myths and rituals, my current scholarship, the Peace Love Yoga Project, asks about the political dimensions of what I'm calling neoliberal spirituality. Of course, the argument that neoliberal capitalism molds cultures of self-care, like yoga, accords with the academic consensus that the present moment's dominant social structures and ideologies shape the ways people are capable of thinking, even when they seek to think beyond or against it. Whichever area of contemporary religion or culture one studies, be it the so-called spiritual but not religious, or the traditionally religiously affiliated, one will likely uncover the assumption among many adherents that a person is entitled to as great a share of the world's resources as that person's money can buy, and in turn, that the needs of capital largely determine the priorities of the respective disciplines, discourses, and institutions, and that they reproduce inequalities and produce surplus value for a privileged minority. Of course, scholars love arguing over the meaning of words, and it's fair to say that neoliberalism is one of the most contested terms in our contemporary lexicon. I'm using neoliberalism here to refer to not just a set of capitalist free market economic policies, but also a governing rationality or way of thinking that disseminates market values and metrics to every sphere of life, formulating everything everywhere in terms of capital, investment, and appreciation, including and especially living beings. Neoliberal governmentality, which holds the individual fully responsible for their conditions, can be seen at play in discourses of self-sufficiency, which reify the individual, construed as a sort of automaton that's ideally self-optimizing, self-sustaining, and entrepreneurial. We can address the politics of neoliberal spirituality by attending to a number of things. For example, the power dynamics underlying cultural appropriation, authoritarian abuses, particularly in cases of sexual abuse. Also, when we speak of the spiritual commodities that consumers describe as empowering, transformative, or liberating, we are not often talking about things that challenge or weaken dominant power structures. Neither do they challenge a conservative mindset. In fact, much of spiritual industry's products are rooted in concerns about deviancy, not only in the form of low productivity, but also forms of social deviancy. So the prescriptions for self-care or personal liberation are rarely concerned with social transformation. Rather, they more often denote the requirements for more productive, efficient, and conforming workers and consumers. In other words, as the demands on people to work and be productive have increased, so we have seen an increase in yoga teachers, natural dietary systems, spiritual athleisure wear, and mindfulness courses, which for the most part claim to enhance productivity and conformity to a rigid, not to mention bodily standard. So the politics of spirituality are visible in the discourses and practices of some of the industry's most powerful corporations and proponents, including the current Prime Minister of India, Narendra Modi, and his spiritual ally and the most famous living yoga guru in India, Baba Ramdev, as well as some of the most popular yoga corporations today, such as Spiritual Gangster, which these images you're seeing now are taken from advertisements for Spiritual Gangster products. Spiritual Gangster is a US-based yoga wear company whose products are, quote, inspired by peace, love, and all things yoga, end quote. This kind of spirituality, though seemingly self-described as concerned about things like peace and love, they also create deviant outgroups. For marketing strategies like these that idealize self-governance, so you can see you're exactly where you're supposed to be, what you think you become, these kinds of discourses, they not only idealized self-governance, this sort of neoliberal idea that we have control over our own conditions rather than larger social forces or social structures. But they also present a sort of very narrow vision of the female body, and in that way create deviant outgroups. If you're outside of this sort of ideal, then you are out. You are an outgroup. So from marketing strategies like these to Modi's claims in India that yoga is a direct path to perfect health and it is Hinduism's gift to the world. Therefore, if you don't choose it, you are a failure with regard to your own self-care. These all function to create deviant outgroups. A wide range of commodities are celebrated as good consumer choices, products that lead to better living outcomes. So if you are unhappy, unwell, stressed, or not the proper weight, that's because you're not making the right consumer choices. You're not buying the right stuff. Where you are in life is on you. Changing your conditions is your responsibility. So this is what I'm talking about when I talk about neoliberal governmentality, this idealized self-governance. In addition to the problems of cultural appropriation and Orientalism, there's also the heteropatriarchy of neoliberal spirituality. In fact, gender is central, not peripheral, to its operations, especially insofar as heteropatriarchy shapes the ways authority is demarcated and exercised, so that structural transformation is not expected as the solution to gender inequities. Rather, resolving those challenges is a burden placed on the shoulders of the disenfranchised, that is, women and gender and women and other gender and sexual minorities. Spiritual commodities, in other words, are an individual's tool for breaking the glass ceiling, not dismantling the ceiling so that all men, all women and other gender and sexual minorities have equal opportunity. So if you're a working mom and feel exhausted all the time, take a yoga class, study mindfulness. This is the way to achieve that envied work-life balance, not demanding structural changes, such as better parental leave policies or childcare at the workplace. Most significantly, spirituality industries individualize what are fundamentally social and political problems in society. rather than this obviously suits neoliberal capitalism. It follows an ideology that you need to work on yourself rather than look to social resources for solutions to your problems or demand structural changes. So their discourses are highly useful in depoliticizing the oppressive and increasingly grim reality of life for many on this planet. The obstacles of capitalism that capitalism poses are the very challenges of what many are calling the Anthropocene. The main force behind this period in the Earth's history is capitalism's global exponential growth. Capitalists generally recognize no limits to its expansion. No amount of profit, wealth, or consumption is enough or too much. And as a consequence of capitalism's exponential growth, as I speak, the world suffers from increased global warmth and the natural catastrophes to which it contributes. Specifically, things like carbon dioxide emissions, ocean acidification, fossil fuel combustion, mass species extinctions, and other losses in biological diversity. Forest loss, resulting in a planetary ecological emergency or Earth system crisis. So devastating natural events from flooding and hurricanes to tornadoes and forest fires, not to mention the current global pandemic, are increasingly becoming the norm. The involvement or complicity of spiritual industries here then is only one factor in the bigger problem, which is of course the way the neoliberal capitalist project destroys the social, the collective, and the environment. Namaste all day. Good karma. Self-love club. Dope soul. Zen AF, that is Zen as fuck. And my personal favorite, your ego is not your amigo. These are just a few of the catchy phrases we see printed across yoga wear. The website for Spiritual Gangster displays beautiful, slim, young, usually white bodies clad in remarkable combinations of cotton and spandex, and forever in a state of leisure at varying locations, ranging from an urban basketball court to a bed of white linens and what appears to be a high-end resort, but always with an exotic backdrop. This is the person you should be, lounging in your yoga pants, or in this case, no pants at all. You would feel beautiful, positive, relaxed, and spiritual. But in a fleeting moment, you might also slip into a painfully reflexive state as you realize you are also a cog in the economic and social machine of neoliberal capitalism. You might marvel and then retract at the neoliberal project's magical abilities to cultivate perpetual anxiety about not only your productivity, but also your responsibility for every dimension of life, to make you work more, even when doing so brings less in return, and to create a void, and then to fill it. Spiritual gangster yoga wear is just one articulation of this peculiar variant of spirituality that has come to the forefront of global culture in the past few decades, and incites adherents to accept full responsibility for their own well-being, self-care, and liberation. Our mission, according to its website, is, quote, to inspire positivity, generosity, kindness, and connectedness. With this goal in mind, may all beings everywhere be happy and free. We are connected. We are the same. We are one, end quote. So there's a rich archive of these spiritual discourses, from those printed across yoga wear to mindfulness manuals and health foods packaging. So to draw a few examples that might be somewhat less high-end or even widely known as spiritual gangster, I'm just going to talk about a few other examples here. Oops, sorry about that. There we go. So in response to how to change your attitude when you cannot change your circumstances, Jewish American health coach, mindful weight loss entrepreneur, and self-described foremost expert on Maimonides in ancient health, David Zolberg advises, quote, change your perception, belief, or opinion of the situation, and that will help you change your attitude. Some other tidbits of advice include, admit to yourself that you're not happy. Realize optimism is a choice. Use positive words. Hang out with friends who have a happy vibe. And say a daily affirmation. Hindu yoga guru, activist, entrepreneur, and television celebrity Baba Ramdev, who I mentioned on a previous slide, similarly espouses a message of positive thinking and self-care, which he disseminates across India through speeches, interviews, advertisements, and other media platforms. This self-care spirituality is precisely the kind that informs best-selling manifestos, such as the Whole Foods CEO John Mackey's Conscious Capitalism, in which the ideal person is construed as that automatized, self-optimized, and entrepreneurial self. Now, neoliberal commodities tend to embody all sorts of contradictions, giving rise to social and political controversies, including that which arose around the closure of the Burrard Street Bridge for the 2015 International Day of Yoga. In 2015 in Vancouver, home to yoga apparel giant Lululemon, a scheduled yoga day event threatened to divide the city and the local yoga community due to the province of British Columbia's proposed $150,000 contribution. Corporate sponsors, including Lululemon, and the planned 7-hour Own the Bridge closure. The added irony was that the event was largely sponsored by an affluent white Canadian demographic and threatened to eclipse National Aboriginal Day, all while its organizers claimed to celebrate an ancient system of knowledge indigenous to India, that is yoga. The event was canceled following a week of protest. Events for Yoga Day have even sparked controversy in India, where Indian Muslims protested Yoga Day events, arguing they serve right-wing Prime Minister Narendra Modi's, quote, saffron agenda. That is his Hindu nationalism. And this image that you're seeing on the left is Modi seated next to Baba Ramdev. Modi is a tight ally of Baba Ramdev, who has worked to criminalize same-sex sex in India. He has described homosexuality as a disease, and he's prescribed yoga as the cure to homosexuality. Now, there's a paradox in Ramdev's work. On the one hand, Ramdev's stance seems fundamentally nationalist and conservative. He profits off of products marketed as traditional natural foods and ancient medicinal practices. In Ramdev, his corporation, called Patanjali Ayurveda, has a strong brand ambassador, one credited with bringing yoga to the mainstream in India. He has supporters across the country who choose Patanjali Ayurveda products because of the yogic authority they invest in its ambassador, as well as the nationalist associations of the brand. Ramdev consistently positions Patanjali Ayurveda as a homegrown Indian company fighting global multinational competitors. Ramdev is piggybacking on Modi's Make in India campaign to promote his goods. Although his company's logo and packaging use the orange, white, and green of the Indian flag, and although packaging information is written in English, it says Made in Bharat, using the country's Hindi name, rather than Made in India. All of Patanjali Ayurveda's products are marketed as Swadeshi, meaning of one's own country or indigenous to India. So these are meant to combat forms of Western appropriation of Indian cultural products. But like other entrepreneurs selling yoga and associated appropriated cultural products globally, Ramdev is also building a massive corporation selling packaged, branded, and commercialized products with sleek modern advertising, and he thrives in a modern health and wellness sector that is growing globally. A sector that calls on consumers to take responsibility for their health, wellness, success, and empowerment. His products he's even announced plans to include athleisure apparel products in the larger athleisure industry, but products that are, again, quote, made in Bharat. And so his yoga wear would be more authentic yoga wear as opposed to those of companies engaged in cultural appropriation, or at least that's his view. Ramdev is helping to successfully accelerate yoga's industry into the 21st century neoliberal capitalist global economy. He's playing a modern, urban, right-wing, and neoliberal game. It thrives on nostalgia about lost cultural norms, as well as neoliberal narratives about the value of self-care, personal improvement, and free choice. Entrepreneurial gurus like these might be appealing in part because they successfully appropriate and commodify the ancient ideas and symbols of India, but they also represent one expression of a global shift toward a form of spirituality that uses commodities and consumption to demarcate the morally acceptable. Now, believe it or not, I do not mean to offer just one more voice bemoaning the commodification of spirituality or yoga as a numbing device through which consumers ignore the problems of capitalism or as the corruption or loss of authentic yoga. Many scholars, and these book covers provide a couple of examples, have already offered referenda on spiritual commodities. They often suggest that spiritual commodities merely serve as palliatives or coping mechanisms. These commodities, in their view, function like a fetish that help consumers feel as if they've escaped reality. In other words, they offer consumers an escape into an experience of the present moment, of a romanticized or orientalized other, or an idealized ancient past, which allows them to imagine themselves as separate from the busyness of everyday life, and by extension, disconnected from the social and economic relations of global capitalism. I do not think of spiritual and self-care consumers as duped into buying commodities that numb them to the violence of capitalism. So my position is different than that. That said, I do agree that the solutions to consumers' problems that spiritual commodities offer usually do not elide the structural and economic undergirding of the Earth's population's greatest threats. For example, environmental degradation. By ignoring that socioeconomic and cultural structures shape our lives, they ensure greater conformity to the reigning ideology and system largely responsible for conditions of exploitation in a dehumanizing workplace, assaults against democracy, and vast social inequalities and environmental disruptions. So these critical contributions to the study of spirituality examine the material and social operations of spiritual commodities, pursued with a sensitivity to subtle, and sometimes not so subtle, power dynamics, complicating any straightforward progress narrative about religious democratization, increased choice, or individual autonomy among spiritual consumers, pointing out that this form of spirituality ultimately directs its address to the middle and upper classes, effectively erasing the problems faced by the vast majority of the population. Furthermore, as much as individual consumers are not in control of their physical living conditions or places on the socioeconomic hierarchy, spiritual shopping gives consumers a sense of control over their lives. Adherents of this type of spirituality use the notion of consumer choice to convince themselves that they are in control of their well-being, self-care, happiness, and empowerment. So while acknowledging some of these insights of other studies on spirituality, while also resisting this argument that spiritual consumers are somehow numbed to the violence of consumer capitalism, I want to invite us to consider what I think is a more nuanced analysis. So I ask what we should make of the subversive anti-capitalist gestures of spirituality that do call on adherents to think beyond the individual and even out into the environment. Spiritual gangsters products, for example, range from yoga pants with good vibes appliqued across the butt to t-shirts mentioned earlier reading peace, love, yoga, as if these three were inherently compatible and mutually reinforcing commitments. The appropriation of gangster itself could be read as subversive, since the gangster is historically a space of Black resistance. According to the Spiritual Gangster website, we exercise love as the most powerful form of activism. The company also donates an unspecified percentage of every sale to provide food for those living in poverty. What about these entrepreneurs and corporations profiting off spiritual commodities that claim to counter the problems of unbridled capitalism with charitable giving or various forms of conscious capitalism? What should we make of the Indian state's efforts to challenge cultural appropriation, the imperialism behind Western commodifications of yoga, more specifically the North American multi-billion dollar yoga industry, by reclaiming yoga for India? Or the famous Baba Ramdev's company, Patanjali Ayurveda, which claims to offer alternatives to the products of Western appropriations and commodifications. What should we make of feminist spiritual discourses, the calls for women's empowerment that are nearly ubiquitous in spiritual discourses, all while placing the burden of success on individual women and their willingness to work hard, think positively, and aspire for equality? Some spiritual consumers might greenwash the products they buy, from yoga apparel to tableware. Everywhere in the developed world, plastic has taken over our households, accessories, and even our clothes. And there's growing concern over the images broadcast across the mainstream media of plastic waste crowding oceans and beaches. Spiritual consumers might respond by opting for the high-end apparel of Sattva Living, which offers, quote, mindfully designed organic fashion, quote. The company claims to improve the health and wellness of conscious consumers, as well as the lives of Indian organic farmers, by partnering with Sumintir India Organics and working under the model of creative capitalism, an approach that ensures that a portion of profits are invested back into the communities and agricultural programs of the farmers themselves. Sattva Living products are sold across India, as well as the United States, and are available, for example, at Whole Foods Market, where spiritual consumers might also shop for eco-friendly biodegradable paper plates. And I've already mentioned the CEO and founder of Whole Foods Market, John Mackey, and his book, Conscious Capitalism, in which he argues that the capitalism's, quote, heroic spirit is the key to creating a world in which all people live lives full of prosperity, love, and creativity. A world of compassion and freedom, end quote. So I suggest we attend to these anti-capitalist gestures that rather than a mode through which consumers ignore, escape, or are numbed to the problems of capitalism, many spiritual commodities, corporations, and entrepreneurs do actually acknowledge those problems. And in fact, they do subvert them or resist them, but they do so through mere gestures. So from provocative taglines printed across t-shirts or packaging to various forms of charitable giving, commodification is a strategy through which subversion or resistance itself is contained. In other words, neoliberal spirituality represents a collection of industries through which protest against the dominant socioeconomic and cultural order is simultaneously expressed and contained. So, In my scholarship, I draw on social theorist Mark Fisher, who describes these kinds of anti-capitalist gestures in other areas of pop culture. He discusses, for example, Hollywood movies or television. How often is the villain the evil corporation? And as Fisher points out, Hollywood films like these villainize capitalism. And in so doing, they perform our anti-capitalism for us, allowing us to continue to consume without blame or guilt. In other words, in my view, spirituality with its countercultural or subversive gestures is domesticated to the dominant culture, like Hollywood films. It's domesticated to a neoliberal capitalist way of thinking. Another way to put this is that consumption of spiritual commodities entails a mistake, whereby the consumer confronts certain problems of capitalism by consuming. That is, by buying products of a sustainable brand name in a way akin to how a white consumer paying for a yoga class with a teacher who's traveled and studied in India might assume that class is closer to authentic yoga than one offered by a teacher who's just studied domestically. In both cases, the consumer choices themselves confront some of the greatest problems of capitalism, say environmental degradation or cultural appropriation, without impunity for those problems, without taking real responsibility for them. Contrast this with the kind of self-care, contrast this kind of self-care with that of activists who refuse to cooperate with the dominant power structures, offering instead perspectives that emphasize a type of agency exercised through critiques and diagnoses of unequal power structures, solidarity building, educational campaigns, and ultimately revolution. In 1988, Black lesbian writer and activist Audre Lorde famously said, quote, "Caring for myself is not self-indulgence, it is self-preservation, and that is an act of political warfare," end quote. The call here was to use self-care as a means to remaining ever alert to the threat of social inequality and the responsibility of radicals to sustain political commitment and to manifest social solidarity, which required that they insist that they, whether Black, brown, female, queer, whatever, are worthy of care. More recently, the most notable climate activist today, Greta Thunberg, has demanded action in the form of concrete policy changes to prevent catastrophic climate change. This 16-year-old climate activist is a leading figure in the climate justice movement, inspiring millions across the globe since she's launched her school strike in 2018. Thunberg is also on the autism spectrum and has faced insults and criticisms in light of that. She's responded, quote, "When haters go after your looks and differences, it means they have nowhere else to go. And then you know you're winning," end quote. And she uses the hashtag #AskBePower. Let's see. So there's often a desire for a narrative of unity, as if there's an essence or core to spirituality, the yoga industry, and the cultures from which they appropriate. But the discomfort that comes with efforts to illuminate the differences and discrepancies, even and especially political ones, is necessary. Ultimately, attending to discrepancies and contradictions, acknowledging all of these industries' moving parts, will strengthen the collective project to understand not only spirituality or the yoga industry, but contemporary society as a whole. Spiritual discourses, disciplines, and institutions, including its countless commodities, for example, a t-shirt with peace, love, yoga applicated across the front. They often enact an Orientalist fantasy of enlightenment ethics that's especially seductive in a world of ever-expanding obligations and needs. A desire to resist the violence of capitalism is expressed and then contained in and through its creative usage of neoliberal governance, its capitalist Orientalist tropes, and calls for empowerment and freedom. The text of spirituality provides a theoretical model and ideological justification for a capitalist ethic. For all of the peace and love it offers through yoga, health foods, mindfulness, and countless other modes of self-governance, neoliberal spirituality often plays a divisive and even conservative game that thrives on cultural appropriation and nostalgia about lost cultural norms, demarcating outsiders, as well as narratives about transformation, liberation, and the value of self-care, but within the bounds of unchallenged social structures. So I'm going to stop there because I was told to stop at 11:40 because I wanted to leave some room, some time for questions. So let's maybe end my share screen, because that's the end of my PowerPoint.
All right, so go ahead.
Yeah. I was gonna say I'd be happy to take some questions or comments.
We have some questions in the chat. What percentage of yoga consumers do you estimate engage in this spiritual materialism?
That's a really good question. What percentage? My work is qualitative, not quantitative, so I haven't done quantitative research on, you know, how often we find these kinds of discourses. My Peace Love Yoga book, as well as the Selling Yoga book, look at representations of yoga and pop culture. At the same time, I've done some research among yoga communities that really intentionally seek to represent an alternative form of a yoga or spirituality. I know they absolutely exist. And in fact, there are yoga communities out there that are really creating different kinds of institutions that resist capitalist hierarchies, patriarchal hierarchies. And I don't know statistically what the percentage is, but they definitely exist, but they're on the margins of global yoga or the global yoga world.
And then another question, I've heard the argument defense that spiritual commodification is a way to make yoga more accessible for those who might otherwise have not considered themselves spiritual or are just yoga evolving to fit modern needs. What would you say to those who believe this? Is there a place for new liberal spirituality in yoga or vice versa?
I think that in some ways the commodification of yoga does make yoga more accessible. So especially in my selling yoga book, where I kind of trace how yoga became a global commodity, I talk about how yoga began to become something in the late 20th century that people could learn about by buying a cheap paperback or flipping on their television. They didn't have to travel to India and find a guru, right? And so there was a democratizing element to the popularization of yoga and even its commodification that made it more accessible. Where I sort of resist seeing that as an egalitarian move or a move toward equity is by pointing out that even if yoga became a part of pop culture and more accessible, it became accessible to a limited number of communities, particularly middle and upper classes, people who not only could afford to buy those paperbacks, even if they're inexpensive paperbacks, it's still commodity purchases, and people who could afford to have time. So there's all sorts of privilege. There's not just economic privilege, but there's time privilege. And people who have time to engage in practices of self-care like yoga or mindfulness, or to buy health foods and do the research about what foods are healthier than others, that kind of privilege oftentimes goes hand in hand with economic privilege, time privilege. And so even if it's more accessible to more people, it's specific types of people. And I also want to just point out that even in cases where yoga is offered as a free product, so for example, in Peace Love Yoga, I write about prison yoga and the ways that yoga has been introduced into prison contexts as an alternative form of rehabilitation. There we still see a form of neoliberal governance. And so we see the burden of healing and rehabilitation put on the shoulders of individual prisoners, as opposed to efforts to dismantle the prison industrial complex, which itself is the cause of the very trauma that prisoners are now seeking to heal. But again, taking responsibility for that healing themselves that was caused by larger social structures. That was kind of a long-winded answer to the question, but I hope it was helpful.
Yeah, these are rich questions coming in. So the next one, you have well highlighted that commodified yoga and new age gadgets as pacifiers, but what of problems of industrialized Western medicine, for example, pharmaceuticals, positive effects of breath, emotional input, individual inputs into ongoing illnesses, positive as alternatives, but simultaneously are part of health resistance?
I think that question, what I'm hearing is a question about how are yoga commodities any different from larger pharmaceutical interventions when it comes to health and wellness? And I would say they're not, but they are oftentimes framed as alternatives. And so you see spiritual commodities as oftentimes marketed as alternative interventions for health and wellness. But I don't see them as quite as countercultural or really alternative to capitalism. Either way, pharmaceutical companies are capital, you know, a part of capitalist industries. The aim is more the pursuit of profit than it is of the pursuit of equity, justice, health, you know, health and access to health care for all. And likewise with the spiritual industry, the aim is often, and again, not always, there are exceptions, but often concerned with profit and perpetuating a mode of neoliberal governance where people are responsible for their own health and wellness.
Thank you. A couple more. How do these ideas relate to the idea of toxic positivity?
Yeah, I think that's a really good question. This pressure, especially on certain populations, especially women, to be positive all the time, to smile all the time. Again, this puts the burden on individual women and others to take responsibility for their own emotional wellness. And we are oftentimes not in control of this, right? We aren't in control of the level of stress we're enduring. And so I like to provide this example that I mentioned in the talk about working mothers. You can imagine, or you might be one, you might know one, a working mom who is experiencing a great deal of stress and exhaustion, working shifts at work and then coming home to home care and child care, and not having resources to help them so that they can work, take care of their children, and take care of themselves. And oftentimes interventions prescribed are take a yoga class, study mindfulness, eat better, exercise more. These are the interventions that are going to help you, and so that you're not feeling depressed, sad, anxious. What my argument is that it's not that yoga and mindfulness don't help with things like stress, sadness, and anxiety, but they might limit the extent to which we resist institutions that are not fair for women, for example, where women need childcare at the workplace, expanded parental leave policies. These are structural changes that would help women. It's not enough to simply tell them that it's their responsibility to take a yoga class as if that's the solution to their problems. So that's how it relates to toxic positivity. Toxic positivity is just another manifestation of neoliberal governance. It's like, I am responsible for being happy all the time, even if I'm getting 5 hours of sleep a night, you know, and am overworked and exhausted all the time.
Right. And then we have another one. As someone who practices yoga, what additional steps can we take to respectfully do yoga?
So I tend to resist these kinds of questions, to be honest with you. I see myself as what I call a sort of cultural diagnostician. You know, I as a scholar of religion and culture, see myself as the person who deconstructs culture, diagnoses the problems. I leave it to activists to tell us how to get out of it. I point to Angela Davis, for example, as an activist who provides constructive visions for how to counter the problems of capitalism and patriarchy. I think there are many spiritual leaders and yoga leaders who are doing this as well. But that's not me. I'm not the constructive visionary. I'm the deconstructive social critic. I think that kind of deconstructive diagnostic work is important for building forms of activism that resist. But that just hasn't been my project.
We do have another question. It might be the same kind of answer from you. How I think they mean, what can the yoga community do to assist in creating real systemic change and not just provide a feel-good band-aid?
I think, again, I'm sort of resistant to prescribing what I see as the solution, right, to the problems that I diagnose. But I would say that a sort of truly alternative community would require a different form, different forms of social structuring. And so that community, for example, would aspire to be less hierarchical, less profit-driven and profit-oriented, concerned about not just diversifying, not just having people of color, for example, in the space where yoga is being practiced, but actually giving people a platform, people who have been historically disadvantaged, a platform to speak and lead. And so those are just some of the examples of ways in which a community might counter in more structural ways the forces of capitalism and the ways it dominates the yoga industry.
We have another question. Andrea, what session or sessions are you looking forward to that may address the visionary versus the diagnostic response you just mentioned? I think they're referring to maybe other sessions at the conference. I don't know if you had a chance to look through.
That's a good question. I don't know. I haven't actually really explored much on those topics in the conference. I'm a working mom myself. I have two kids who are e-learners, and I have them home most of the time. And my oldest son is on the autism spectrum. So having a child with special needs home, e-learning has prevented me from being able to do much in terms of listening and learning. I'm still sort of adjusting to this new world of pandemic life.
Yeah, it's a lot to adjust to. If anybody else has maybe a question they want to ask live, you could raise your hand. We have time for maybe just one more. If you have a comment, something you want to say to Andrea, feel free to use the raise hand button and we can bring you up and unmute you. And while you're doing that, Andrea, I'm curious how you came to be involved in studying this topic.
Yeah, so I was in graduate school in Houston at Rice University getting a PhD in religious studies. And I was interested in actually Hindu bhakti, devotional traditions. And I was interested in bhakti because I wanted to explore questions around religion and the body, the ways in which religion intersects with sexual practices and other embodied practices. And I wanted to look at those questions by exploring Hindu bhakti. But then I was in India doing some research and I accidentally stumbled upon a yoga guru there who was prescribing a form of yoga that didn't look so different from the yoga I'd experienced on my college campus when I took a yoga class as an undergraduate. And I thought it was really fascinating how yoga wasn't just, it had gone global, but wasn't simply Americanized. It wasn't like there was Indian yoga and American yoga. There was this global popular yoga that you found in all across the world. And so that got me sucked into the study of yoga as a body practice. And so I continued my interest in the relationship between religion and the body and embodied practices. But I went down the path of studying modern yoga and in particular yoga in capitalism.
Fascinating. One more question came in. What has been the most surprising finding you've come across in this work?
You know, I think that maybe the example of the prison yoga. I started the Peace Love Yoga Project several years ago with the intention of actually writing a book that was more focused on prison yoga. And I was going into that work thinking that this really did provide a sort of anti-capitalist form of yoga. And then was surprised and disappointed to find that in many contexts where neoliberal or where yoga is taught in prison contexts, it still has that neoliberal governmentality. And so that was a big surprise for me. And I think that the sort of wake up for me was a sort of political moment when we saw Brexit and the election of Donald Trump and Narendra Modi's rise to power in India, this sort of right wing moment in global history where, you know, the sort of, for me, the illusion of progress was lifted, this kind of veil of illusion. And I kind of shifted to a more critical eye.
Andrea, thank you for sharing your depth of knowledge with us. We really appreciate you being here. Just a few announcements to end. Please feel free to connect with one another in the coffee breaks and the Facebook group. We're going to have some links going into the chat right now of how you can access those groups and links for Andrea to connect with Andrea and read her book, digest her work. So check that out. We'll be taking an hour break. Please take care of yourself during this break. Do what you need for yourself. And when we come back after the keynote speaker, so it'll be in a few hours, we'll have Gail Parker sharing restorative yoga for race-based traumatic stress. Again, this session will be free to watch for 48 hours on the website, on our Facebook page. And if you want to own this forever, you can own it through purchasing the sales package of recordings. And I want to turn it back to you, Andrea, for just one more thing. I'd love to hear your top tip for how to stay embodied.
Oh, that's a good question. Let's see. I think that I suppose my top tip for staying embodied is cultivating community. I think that, you know, having people who care for us is the key way to remember our own embodiment. Experiencing love and care by others, and that takes work, creating and cultivating and giving to those communities. And so I'd encourage everyone, especially in this time of pandemic when we're increasingly isolated, to really nourish the communities you do have. And you know, to take care of those communities for the sake of your own body, but also the bodies of those who are also in your community.
Well said, I love that. Okay, thank you so much, Andrea. Thank you everybody for being here. Take good care of yourself during this break.
And thank you everyone, this was great, thank you.